Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, April 12, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group telephone conference call. Today, we're going to be discussing the role of the NSA and DoD in cybersecurity. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome as our moderator and discussion leader, Ellen Nakashima. She is a national security reporter for the Washington Post, where she focuses on issues relating to intelligence, technology, and civil liberties. She's going to lead our discussion with three other panelists, each of whom will speak for some 6 to 8 minutes in opening remarks. Then there'll be some discussion moderated by Ms. Nakashima, and then we'll take audience questions. Our other speakers, in the order they'll present, are Stephen Bradbury, a partner at Deckert and former head of the Office of Legal Counsel at the Department of Justice. Second, we'll hear from Michelle Richardson, who is the legislative counsel for the ACLU, and also a fellow in the Stanford Law Center for Internet and Society. And then we will hear from Joel Brenner, who is a principal in his own firm, Joel Brenner LLC, but also author of the book America, The Vulnerable. Their bios, more complete bios, have been provided to you in a notice you received of this call. So for further information on that front, visit our website or revert to the email we had sent noticing this call. I will check back in when we're ready for questions from our audience. But with that, Ellen Nakashima, please go right ahead with the program.
Thank you very much, Dean. Thanks to the Federalist Society for putting this teleconference together. I'll keep my opening remarks brief so we can maximize time for discussion later. One thing is clear now that cybersecurity is a top national security issue on the administration's agenda. And the administration has also made clear that the Department of Homeland Security has the lead role in dealing with critical infrastructure and domestic cybersecurity, and that cybersecurity is, as they like to say, a whole of government effort between DHS, FBI, the Pentagon, National Security Agency, State Department, just to name the largest. But when it comes to defense of the nation, here the administration has decided that a military agency, Cyber Command, closely allied with the NSA, should have the role of blocking major attacks aimed at critical infrastructure inside the U.S. Over the next hour, we're going to explore some of these the issues that arise from that interesting role now that the administration has decided Cyber Command should play. And I, with that, like to just turn it right over to you, Steve, to make some remarks, and then at the end we'll recap and start our discussion. Take it away.
Terrific. Thank you, Ellen. And again, this is Steve Bradbury. And in my brief opening remarks, I want to talk a little bit about the legal framework that governs in this area and covers these issues that I think will kind of set the framework for the discussion. We have a legal tradition in the United States that dates from the administration of George Washington that our armed forces in the Department of Defense protect us from international threats, foreign threats to the United States, but do not participate, at least in a command and control role, in domestic law enforcement, except in extraordinary instances like cases of insurrection or cases where local authorities are overwhelmed, when we might actually put boots on the ground from the Pentagon in assisting in domestic law enforcement. However, there may be situations where the Defense Department has special assets or capabilities that can be employed, and perhaps unique capabilities that can be employed to assist in domestic security efforts, and also where the nature of the security threat is unclear and may overlap between domestic or criminal security issues and foreign threats. And those two points certainly lead to an understanding, at least a background understanding, of the unique role that the National Security Agency plays in connection with domestic cybersecurity. The National Security Agency is a component of the Department of Defense under the command of the Secretary of Defense, and the Director of the National Security Agency, General Keith Alexander, is the head of Cyber Command, which has been stood up by the President to be a lead component or a primary component in cybersecurity efforts, both defensive and offensive. I want to talk for a minute about the approach the federal government is taking to the security of federal government network systems, and then talk for just a brief moment about how that might be expanded beyond the federal government computer systems to perhaps the systems of critical infrastructure operators, and potentially even beyond that. And this, I think, will help to understand the role that the National Security Agency and U.S. Cyber Command plays in all of this. There is a legal opinion the Justice Department provided on these issues, which I actually I signed the first big legal opinion on this question, and the current administration has publicly disclosed these legal advice memos. And it relates to a system called Einstein that the federal government is still developing, is rolling out, for the purpose of protecting U.S. federal government computers networks from cybersecurity intrusions. This is going to be under the control and aegis of the Department of Homeland Security, but with the assistance of Cyber Command and the assistance of the computer power and analysis capabilities of the National Security Agency. And the way it is envisioned that it will work is on the perimeters of the federal government computer network systems where they interconnect to the internet, the gateways to the internet, there will be systems in place to create mirror images of all the traffic going in and out of the internet, of the gateway, in order to search that traffic for what's called signatures of potential unwanted intrusions. And these signatures are a constantly changing list of signatures that are developed in real time from many different streams of sources, private virus protection firms that collect information about intrusions, our own review of our own internal computer systems, Also, law enforcement, cybercrime investigations, and foreign and domestic intelligence agencies that collect information on potential intrusions into sensitive computer networks. And those signatures are then used to identify potential messages that are of a threat to the computer system, that can then be analyzed further by human analysts, and then appropriate action can be taken, either law enforcement action if the intrusion seems to be coming from a domestic source, or potentially counterintelligence action, or even potentially military action if it's coming from a foreign government or a foreign another foreign threat. This is still being rolled out, as I say, and the legal basis for it is basically a consent theory. All the users of the computer networks in the U.S. government agencies that participate in this system sign user agreements and have logon banners on their computers and get training so they all understand and consent that all of their communications over the network as they go in and out may be subject to review, and the information gained may be used for any authorized purpose. And that goes for any of the information that traverses over the computers for purposes of examining whether there's been a virus or other intrusion into the system. Question is, could that be expanded beyond federal government systems? And there's a lot of focus on critical infrastructure networks for sensitive infrastructure facilities like dams, electric power grids, nuclear power plants, et cetera. And classified government programs from defense contractors. One way that could potentially be done to expand the use of Einstein in that way would be, again, through a consent theory. all have all of the users on that particular infrastructure operator's network sign user agreements or have logon networks, ensure that it's a discrete controlled network with identifiable gateways to the internet, and then the government could require, either in theory, either by contract, if it's a government contractor, or by regulation and potentially legislation, that the operators of those networks ensure that the stream of information passing over the gateway is reviewed in the same way Einstein does for the federal government, and they could contract with Einstein to do that. The final thing I want to mention is, you know, there's been some discussion about, well, whether could you do that for the whole public internet? Because, of course, foreign intrusions and these security issues, security problems come into computer networks from the public internet. Here, I think this consent theory probably breaks down. It would be very difficult to try to put in place that kind of legal basis for a general firewall type review of everything that's streaming over the public backbones of the internet. And I don't see that as a feasible policy result that Congress would probably pursue. You could theorize some kind of licensing arrangement with ISPs to make that happen, but I just don't see that as a feasible solution. We have enough to bite off and chew on in terms of protecting the government's networks and all of the critical infrastructure networks in the country. So I'll stop there, Ellen, and be happy later to answer questions on these issues and develop it further.
Great, great, Steve. That was a terrific overview of the current situation and also possible some possible solutions. Michelle, do you want to pick up on that, on what Steve was talking about in terms of you know, protecting the private sector systems using some form of monitoring?
Sure. Thanks, Ellen, and thanks to the Federal Society for hosting this. The ACLU has been watching the cyber debate and participating in it for the last couple of years. And, you know, one of our top issues has been the topic of today's phone call and the role of the military and civilian agencies in domestic cybersecurity. And this is really one of the top issues that the administration and Congress needs to address as it continues to build out these programs. It's been pretty clear that when we're speaking about operations abroad or foreign communications, the NSA and the military is empowered to respond there. Their authority has only grown over the last decade in the post-9/11 era, both legally and on a very practical basis with resources put there in both computers and people. And it has really grown to an extraordinary powerhouse there. The question, though, is should they be the lead operators when it comes to domestic operations? And the debate we see now in Congress with the many different pieces of legislation is how that is going to be deployed here in the United States, where it's going to affect Americans and Americans' information. And there, the connection to a foreign actor and a military role is much more attenuated. And like Steve said, you know, we have a history in the United States of creating somewhat of a firewall between our military and our traditional law enforcement and other government services. And the military is not supposed to be empowered to act in the United States against Americans. And allowing the NSA or somewhere else in DOD to expand into civilian cybersecurity programs would be a major change in policy and an incredibly dangerous one. So we have praised the administration for keeping the domestic cybersecurity programs in civilian hands, and we are strongly urging Congress that as they go forward, that they continue to do the same. But that question is not resolved. For example, right now there is legislation scheduled for the House floor just next week that will increase information sharing. And this is getting somewhat to what Steve brought up and this idea that the owners and operators are going to be coming across information. They'll be scanning their networks for known threat signatures. And what do they do when they come across it? And the bill being proposed in the House would say that notwithstanding any provision of law, so none of the privacy laws currently on the books would continue to be in force, but notwithstanding any provision of law, these entities can turn over the information to each other and to the government. And it doesn't necessarily say that only the narrow threat signatures can be turned over, stripped of personal information, but gives them broader authority, and that it could go to agencies like the NSA or somewhere else in the Department of Defense. And so we are urging that Congress not take that approach and instead do something much narrower. Steve brought up Einstein, which is a good example of where an argument or a program that applies to government networks don't necessarily translate out to a good approach for the internet at writ large. I'm suspicious about whether something like Einstein could be applied to all critical infrastructure. I think something like that makes sense for, I guess, what we would call the critical infrastructure of 30 years ago, the bridges and the dams and things like that. Those sorts of entities aren't going to be collecting personal information. To the extent that it's caught up in their system, it is truly incidental, and it may be perhaps like the employees, for example, that work at those facilities. There's not going to be a lot of public interaction. The problem, though, is that critical infrastructure now also includes things like the telecommunications industry and the internet itself. And so if you apply a program like that to all of critical infrastructure, you are wrapping in people and everyday American internet users into that program and becomes much more difficult to disentangle the average everyday Americans and what directly affects the critical infrastructure in and of itself. It's very possible that the two are inextricably linked at this point, and that sort of mass surveillance would be inappropriate. So I'll just add, you know, there's still a fight over who's going to control cybersecurity programs. And while the administration has made some pretty clear statements, especially through the recent executive order in February, that DHS and civilian agencies will be lead here in the U.S. on these domestic programs, there's a significant pushback among some of the actors on the Hill and some of the corporations who want to push this back into the work of the NSA. That has really significant impacts for privacy and civil liberties. You know, once these programs are put into the NSA bucket, it's like a black hole. There's no public oversight. There's no meaningful information. There's no information even given to members of Congress about how these programs are implemented and what the protections are. We've seen in the past that members, even on the intelligence committees who are tasked with conducting oversight over these programs, don't get basic information about how these programs are deployed. And so the consequences of letting the NSA come in or other parts of DOD come in and run these programs, you know, has grave consequences, and it's something that needs to be avoided.
Wow, great, Michelle. Thank you. From Michelle's remarks, we can really see that there is still great public concern and wariness of having an intelligence agency like the NSA and a military agency like Cyber Command play a major role in domestic cybersecurity. I'll note that just this week, a senior Pentagon official at another cyber conference stressed that the DOD's role is quite limited in domestic cybersecurity and would only come into play in the case of major cyber attacks. So, for instance, not in economic espionage or cybercrime. But nonetheless, there are still great concerns about just what its role would be, how would the information be shared and with whom, and what protections are there for privacy and civil liberties. And so, Joel, as a former Inspector General of the NSA, this, you're in a great position to, I think, follow up to Michelle's remarks and provide us with some of your own insights.
Ellen, I'll do my best. And thanks to Steve and Michelle and the Federal Society for making this conversation possible. We've talked a lot, or you've talked a lot already, about principles and the law. And I want to talk for a bit with those principles in mind about practically what's going on and why this problem set is as difficult as it is. And I think I want to begin by posing the question I think that we're grappling with, which is there a practical alternative to NSA's playing a major role in network security in the United States? And if not, how do we prevent the defense departments from taking over everything? The first question is actually pretty easy. There is no practical alternative to NSA's playing a major role. And so we're going to be focused instead on how to constrain that agency, how to keep it roped in. And the reason I say that there's no practical alternative is that there is no other place in the government with the expertise and the resources to do this. A few years ago, when Secretary Napolitano, on the 1st October that was declared as a National Computer Security Week or something of that sort, announced that DHS was going to hire 3,000 world-class, top-flight computer forensic experts or computer operators. And everybody sort of looked cross-eyed at each other because everybody who understands this area knows there weren't 3,000 such people available. And so, indeed, DHS has significantly restrained its goals, and even in hiring in the several years since then, I don't think they've hired anything like 3,000 such people, not because they don't want to, but because they don't exist. And even if we could do it in theory, the nation isn't going to invest in a second NSA, one of them civilian, one of them Defense Department. So the question becomes then, how does one use the capabilities of that agency in ways that satisfy our historical preference for civilian control of things that take place in the United States and that make those programs transparent, at least in how they operate. Other things that are making the application of the principles that have been articulated today very difficult have to do with the widespread dissolution of the boundaries between all kinds of things that those of us who are older than 25 or so have grown up with. The networks themselves, civilian and military, don't really separate easily, not only because the .mil network operates on a civilian infrastructure, but also because, as a practical matter, the communications that take place in military space take place in large degree on civilian networks. Military operators use civilian networks, and soldiers and sailors and airmen and Marines are doing exactly what people in all of our companies are doing. They're bringing their own devices, which security people know really BYOD stands for bring your own disaster in terms of cybersecurity. But it's happening, and it's happening in battle spaces, so that the communications that military people and civilian people are engaging in look more and more alike and take place over many of the same networks. We're also finding the traditional boundary between foreign and domestic to be extremely difficult, in large part because foreign-to-foreign communications often transverse the United States. They go through domestic U.S. hubs. And distinguishing foreign-to-foreign from other kinds of communications is also very difficult. So those are the sort of dissolution issues, the boundary issues that make application of the general principle, separate military from civilian life, increasingly difficult for us to deal with as a practical matter. Now, I think the general approach of putting DHS clearly in the lead on civilian networks, but backed by capabilities of NSA, is what in the civilian world would be called matrix management. This is the intelligent application of legal authorities and capabilities across departments to the application to particularly difficult problem sets. In general, we don't even try to do this in the United States government, and when we try, we do it very badly. The coordination process across departments is really difficult. And here, it's actually working rather well. There's a lot to be said for both the way we're trying to do it and how well it's working. So I think the problem I would see somewhat differently than Michelle sees it, consistent with the ACLU's historic role of protecting civil liberties. It's not so much that NSA is going to eavesdrop on everybody. The bigger danger, in my view, is that the Defense Department, and I include NSA here, is not very good at strategic thinking. I mean, NSA's long-term view of the strategic horizon is 18 months. So who's thinking about what networks are going to look like, who's going to pay for them, and how they're going to be managed, and how they will be engineered 10 to 15 years down the road? And I think the answer is not very many people are really thinking about that. And I say engineered, I mean engineered for both security and privacy. Now, the Defense Department's DARPA element, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, which has produced so much technical magic over the years, is capable of doing the imaginative technical work that's required in this department. But DARPA is not being resourced for the task. They have some work going on in this area, but not much, surprisingly little. That's problem number one, and it can be fixed. But problem number two is harder to fix because the White House is part of the problem, and the White House doesn't want to fix it. And here's what I mean by that. The cybersecurity, the cyber coordinator job, is really a sad story. It has no power, no depth even for strategic thinking. So in short, we have no long-term strategic, and I want to emphasize civilian, policy thinking to line up with the technical side that DARPA should be doing. So it seems to me if one really wants to influence the long-term development of cybersecurity and privacy, we need to not spend so much money, but rethink the way the White House and the National and Homeland Security Councils are or are not organized around this issue. So let me leave it at that, and back to you, Ellen.
Wow. A lot to chew on and mull over there, Joel. Thank you. Lack of strategic thinking, the blurring of traditional boundaries between foreign and domestic in cyberspace. But when we think about what the government is, various agencies of the government have started to do, and I have covered this now for about 4 years and have actually started to see some movement. It's by any means not where we should be, but they have started to really there are people in every agency now who are focused on cyber, it seems, and they're starting to try to come up with some better coordinated strategies. And I think they are also starting to say more publicly that, look, cybersecurity, domestic cybersecurity, is not a federal government burden alone. There are some, you know, there are some level of responsibility and due diligence that you and the private sector need to be responsible for. The question is just what is that level of security for what types of attacks, what types of systems, and that's where the debate is now, both I think internally and with industry. So the Pentagon and NSA's part of that is just sort of, it is a little limited, but it is a very important part because they have claimed the role of defending the nation against bigger attacks. So as we know, Keith Alexander, General Alexander, is in the process of setting up more than a dozen of these national mission teams that would have the responsibility of safeguarding critical infrastructure from attacks. The question is, what sort of attacks? Where? How do we know when they would swing into action? What they would do under what circumstances is not really clear yet. What we do know, generally speaking, is that they're not expected to act unless an attack is having, say, severe effects, people dying, critical systems failing, you know, jets falling from the sky. So as I said, not economic espionage or cybercrime. But beyond that, the administration is not really explicit, and that is also part of the, I think, challenge is getting some transparency into the debate here. We do get glimpses, though. General Alexander on the Hill recently said it was reasonable to expect that Cyber Command would have the ability to stop a distributed denial of service attack by taking out the bots or the servers controlling the compromised computers. Okay, but whether or not they would do that is a policy call, he said. And then he said that in some cases, such as, say, acts of sabotage that would wipe software from computers and cause them to be replaced, something like the attack on Saudi Aramco maybe, in such cases, he said, he would expect that the Internet service providers, the ISPs, would be best positioned to block such attacks with signatures provided by NSA. So the information sharing, in this case, from the government to the industry. But as Steve and Michelle and Joel have all sort of explained here, this is in part where the issues arise. So just how much of a role do we, the public, want NSA and Cyber Command to have to stop what sort of attacks? I think Joel is right. I mean, you know, you do have to have in some respects, there is no practical alternative to some of NSA's capabilities. But on the other hand, they don't have perfect intelligence, and there's a lot of threat intelligence out already in the private sector that NSA doesn't have. And that's another issue, because they would like to have that information, and as Michelle raised, there are questions about just how do you provide that while protecting privacy and civil liberties. So what about DDoS attacks against banks? Is that more properly a role for the banks to handle? Or what about the ISPs? So I'd like to just sort of open it up from there and maybe ask Steve, Joel, Michelle, are there certain types of attacks that you think NSA's military should be called upon to help deflect? And what are they? You know, in other words, when does an incident warrant a federal response?
Well, those are two this is Steve Bradbury again. Those are two different questions, Ellen. I think what General Alexander, in his capacity as head of Cyber Command, was talking about when he said, "We will only take action as offensive action as Cyber Command where the intrusion has resulted in significant destruction of property or loss of life or threat to persons in the U.S.
Right, or threatens to."
Right, and I think what he's talking about there is an actual military response, an offensive strike, if you will, through the use of cyber capabilities that would actually be targeted at damaging or destroying the source of the intrusion, assuming it's associated with a foreign government or foreign power. But that's not the only way that the U.S. government can respond. There can be intelligence gathering efforts to try to find out the source. There can be efforts that could come under the rubric of counterintelligence, which is not a military response, but it is an intelligence response, but it is an active one to try to protect against an incursion. So disabling the communications ability of a foreign computer or node to get in, to try to protect against the incursion of certain kinds of intrusions, could be done as counterintelligence, could be done as law enforcement. the FBI can be involved, the Department of Homeland Security, or as General Alexander suggested, it could be, at least initially in certain circumstances, left to private efforts, because all of the ISPs and firms that are active on the internet and provide services have a market-based interest in ensuring the integrity and protection of their networks, because their customers aren't going to use them if they're not taking diligent action to try to protect their network. So there's strong incentives for lots of different actors to be involved. But I think a fundamental thing I just want to stress, and this is kind of in response to Michelle's point, I think there cannot be artificially constructed informational firewalls that prevent the sharing of information as we learn about new threats back and forth from private operators or civilian network operators to Cyber Command, and from Cyber Command back to the civilian operators who may need that information. If we do that, we're setting ourselves up again for another cyber version of a 9/11, where because of artificial walls, we've created firewalls, we're not fully understanding and responding to the threats. So that we need to learn from intrusions that are detected so that we can respond. And we never know in advance whether the source of the intrusion is a domestic, purely domestic criminal hacking operation, or is a foreign threat active intrusion from a foreign government like China or a foreign terrorist organization. So we can't blind ourselves to the potential sources of the intrusions and the best way for national security to be able to respond. I guess the last thing I'll just say, Ellen, I just want to say, you know, Joel raises an interesting question about strategic thinking. It seems to me that Cyber Command is naturally in a position to undertake long-term strategic thinking, kind of like an Army Corps of Engineers for cyber protection projects, because its role is national security protection of the U.S. from foreign cyber threats. And it could make recommendations to the Secretary of Homeland Security, who could approve recommendations and make them up to the President, potentially for legislation, if legislation is required. But it seems to me that should be a role that Cyber Command is involved in playing.
Gosh, Steve, this is Joel. I think your faith in the in the ability of Cyber Command and NSA to think about long-term strategy is perhaps misplaced. I don't share it. The wonderful capabilities and wonderful people at those places, but colleagues that I cherish. But I just think we need a civilian, small, but well-resourced civilian cadre in the National and Homeland Security staff that can do this. And obviously that will be enriched by what they learn from Cyber Command and NSA. But this long-term strategy issue, I think, ought to take place in a civilian organization.
Michelle, would you respond, though, to Steve's remarks about how there cannot be an artificially constructed firewall to sharing of information between industry and Cyber Command or NSA? We're setting ourselves up for another 9/11.
Well,
are there alternatives, or can you minimize? What do you think?
Yeah, you know, I think the alternatives are sometimes presented as you either go straight to NSA or prevent them from collecting information at all, and I think there is a huge middle ground in between. And I think the way it's often described is that, you know, we're not trying to recreate the NSA and build up a whole new NSA, mini NSA inside of DHS, but that there's going to be a civilian interface, and there's going to be some filtering at that point. That doesn't mean it has to be slow and clunky or remove information that's going to be necessary to respond to an actual cyber incident, but it means that there is an overarching structure here and people who are civilians that are going to be looking out for privacy and making sure that there are rules in place and that they're enforced to make sure that Americans' internet information is not routinely collected, kept, or distributed. And that is absolutely within the capacity of DHS or NIST or some other civilian agency. And that is what is being contemplated through some of the proposals that the administration has endorsed or the Senate legislation and some of the models that people have been talking about. As far as not knowing where these attacks are coming from, you know, the administration has said over the last year or two that they've gotten much better at attribution. And that doesn't mean necessarily a single individual, but the larger actor. And you can look at the reports from Mandiant or CrowdStrike just in the last couple of months, and there's a lot of attribution going on. And, you know, they could at least tie it to specific state actors or people who are acting on their behalf, because these signatures are actually incredibly revealing for all the effort they go to hide the source of these attacks. And so, you know, if these are foreign attacks, the military has a much larger role here, but if they're domestic, they simply don't. And, you know, when you talk about corporate espionage or everyday financial crimes or DDoS attacks that are basically political statements or prank behavior, you know, those absolutely do not merit a military response. Those are everyday criminal and other behavior that there is capacity to deal with within other agencies. And allowing the military to operate in that space is just too much of a risk.
All right, look, I think you've succeeded in clouding the waters nicely there, Michelle. I mean, you've addressed a whole lot of issues that weren't on the table, but not the question that Ellen has asked, which is, where's the ACLU stand on the point that Steve was making? I think is unimpeachably correct, that we are driving our way into the same corner we were in before 9/11, where our right hand and our left hand can't share information. You said earlier that we could be much better at protecting lots of kinds of civilian critical infrastructure, and that telecommunications are different than dams and stuff. You were right about that. But right now, we can't get through Congress a bill that allows an enormous amount of threat information that resides in the private sector from being shared both among private sector companies and with the government. Because usually when you hear about complaints about information sharing, it's why doesn't the government tell us more things? But as Ellen was saying earlier, there is an enormous amount of really useful information that big companies have that they feel they can't share with one another. How do we break down that wall?
Well, that has, you know, actually hasn't been demonstrated. You know, people point to privacy laws like ECPA and FISA as a hurdle to sharing cyber information, but those have exceptions for self-defense of one's own network and responding to emergencies that allows them to share both content and record. And it really hasn't been demonstrated exactly what the problem is with the information sharing. You know, the House Homeland Security Committee and Intelligence Committees had hearings over the last month where industry representatives went up there and said, no, we are using the ISACs and other sources right now to share information. Maybe there are tweaks here, but this idea that there's this wealth of pressing information that the companies aren't sharing, you know, it hasn't exactly been explained.
Well, you're on to something important there. I agree with substantially with much of what you were saying. I would agree, and I've said in my book, that the privacy excuse for non-sharing information really hides, in many cases, competitive reluctance to do so. Mm-hmm. And I agree with you there that although the service provider exception, which is what you were talking about in the law, that allows companies to do lots of things to protect their own network, doesn't clearly allow them to share information with one another about their about common threats, so that none of the big companies has a clear right to share information about the threat picture that they see, and encouraging that seems to me to be a good idea.
Right.
You're right though, Michelle, that there are lots of non-privacy reasons that sometimes companies hide behind the privacy laws as an excuse. But I you earlier were saying that, and we're talking about CISPA now, the House bill. I thought that the recent amendment made it clear that it was stripped, that the information that would be shared was stripped of non-threat personal information. Isn't that correct?
No, it was offered during the markup, but it failed. And there is no limitation on companies sharing either content or personally identifiable information.
This is Steve Bradbury again. I would just note that in the Einstein system, that any message that is found that is detected to contain one of the threat signatures and is thereby reviewed by human analyst, and by the way, that would be the only messages that would be reviewed by a human analyst, the subsequent disclosure and dissemination of the information from that message to the FBI, to intelligence agencies as necessary, et cetera, potentially even to the military for response, et cetera, would all be subject to the accepted and established minimization procedures that have been approved by the judges on the FISA court for general use under attorney general guidelines in the FISA context. And those procedures require that all information and communications of U.S. persons be stripped out of the message before it's disseminated unless that information is necessary to understanding the national security aspects of the message or whatnot. So there are minimization procedures that are applied in that context, and similar things could be applied with respect to other sharing. The real key thing is the signature information that the NSA and DHS.
Explain what that is a little, Steve, the signature.
Well, it might be a code. It might be, it could reside anywhere in the message, in the addressing information, in the text of the message, or in an attachment. But it is some unique data information. It could be numbers, it could be letters, whatever, that is indicative of a malware or other threat source that has been identified. So,
and usually it has to do with a hidden executable, an executable command.
Like a code
to
take some action once it gets into the computer system. So it could be the signature of a virus, a command for a computer to do something, et cetera. But it indicates something that has been identified as an unwanted threat intrusion into some computer system. And NSA compiles them from intelligence efforts, from law enforcement, from any sources that it can gather.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me, for these purposes, particularly for federal government systems and for the critical infrastructure systems we've been talking about, footnote, I would not include the public internet writ large, as Michelle suggested, as a critical infrastructure system for this purpose. But the discrete networks that we're trying to protect that are involved in critical infrastructure operations or national defense contracting programs, et cetera, you need a list of signatures that is common and that is active and it is continually refreshed in real time as we get new sources of information about threats, so that we can respond in a unified, consistent, and effective way. And that's what we're trying to achieve.
Can this information be minimized, stripped of PII, at network speed and shared out at network speed, as General Alexander likes to say he needs to see it at, if you're going to stop attacks? Is it technically feasible?
Well, I think I'm not sure of the technical capabilities, but I think what he's talking about at network speed is the ability to detect and potentially to block.
Right, but if you're going to
I don't think he's talking about sharing across multiple agencies at network speed. But if you have a system that can detect, and then you can continually feed your roster or your list of signatures as quickly as you can,
right.
That's what's necessary. But I don't think he's excluding the possibility of an intermediary step where someone applies minimization procedures.
Michelle, I think that would be your priority, right?
Right. And, you know, those could be automated also. When these companies or agencies are going to be writing their programs of what's going to be automatically forwarded and shared, I mean, they're making the decision at that point of what is going to be shared and how much information is going to go in the system. And we're just saying at that point, that you strip out the PII, that's not necessary. And so it actually isn't more burdensome and it doesn't slow the system down. You know, we're not talking about them printing out a piece of paper, blacking out names, and then walking it over to the agency. This is all going to be happening in real time over the computers, and they're going to be making these decisions either way. We're just hoping that they are weighted in favor of privacy.
Great. Well, this has been a rich discussion, but we're almost out of time, and I wanted to open it up for discussion, some questions from the audience. So, Dean?
Thank you very much. Yeah, this is Dean Reuter joining again. In a moment, we'll all hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for any of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone to indicate that you have a question. And if you will bear with me, before we go to the audience for questions, let me make a brief commercial announcement about a series of calls we have next week. We'll be testing the patience of our audience, I'm afraid, next week with 5 Teleform conference calls, so one every day. On Monday, we will be launching a new project of the Federalist Society, the Executive Branch Review Project, which will be taking a look at and debating the rise of activity in the administrative state. That will be a Teleform conference call on Monday at 4 p.m., with Senator Mike Lee and Federalist Society founder David McIntosh, so Monday at 4 p.m. On Tuesday at 1, we'll be discussing whether or not we should have an internet sales tax in our country. On Wednesday at 2 p.m., we'll be discussing the Myriad case, which will be argued this week in the Supreme Court, that concerns patenting of DNA and research like that. That's Wednesday at 2. On Thursday at noon, we'll be giving you an litigation update on the HHS mandate, a series of cases filed to challenge the HHS mandate. And then next Friday at noon, we'll be talking about copyright enforcement. So an ambitious week for us. Please check the Federalist Society website for the complete calendar and for more details. But let's turn now to our audience for today and see what's on your mind. Stand by for our announcement. So once again, if you have a question for any of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are completely open. We don't have any questions at this point.
Well, in the meantime, I wanted to get back to sort of the long-term strategic thinking and alternatives. Can anyone think of other alternatives? What about a secure net, as some analyst thinkers have posited, you know, where maybe a government or trusted third party guarantees the security of you know, transactions online in exchange for your using a sort of identity credential or some form of guaranteed identity authentication. And actually, Estonia has a form of this. And it said that even during the distributed denial of service attacks during 2007, its own digital government system remained intact because of this. Joel and Steve, what do you think of the prospects of developing something like that, or even maybe a secure, you know, new internet, just re-architecting it bottom up?
Well, this is Joel. That was a very interesting piece in this morning's Wall Street Journal on the op-ed page by the president of Estonia. I think that's what you're referring to.
Absolutely.
And you've brought up what I think is the underlying issue we've not even touched on today, and that is assured identity. The thing that makes all this mischief possible on the internet is that you really can't know with any degree of certainty who you're really communicating with. And so then the question becomes, can we change that, which is what the Estonians have decided to do, even though it is a very free country, without, we're going to have a big fight with people who think that anonymity is equals privacy. I don't. I think that ultimately that is the fundamental issue, is assuring that when I think I'm dealing with Ellen Nakashima or Michelle Richardson or Steve Bradbury, I really am.
Michelle, what do you think? Oh, go
I'm
ahead.
Sorry, could I just jump in there and take a civil liberties perspective, actually? I think there are a lot of people in this country, perhaps a majority, perhaps many influential Republicans included in Congress, who would think that the proposition of doing something like that is quite un-American, that the internet is a public common space and that we shouldn't be, in effect, requiring national ID cards to enter a public common space. And although you could construct arguments for why and how to do it and the necessity of it, et cetera, I just don't think at the end of the day it's a realistic policy that would be politically accepted in the United States. So I don't see an effort, a real federal effort to try to move the public internet to that kind of regime.
I don't either. But you could. Let me just say, I wasn't proposing that. But you could imagine a situation in which one could opt into that to do certain kinds of transactions or communications.
And that's sort of the idea behind this, is it national trusted identity strategy. I'm getting, all the words wrong, but the acronym, but the White House says.
Well, it starts out as optional. But if it takes off and becomes the actual space in which you really need to operate, that's, if in effect the public internet is migrated to something like that, then what's the difference between that and a common space?
Well, you do allow free choice. And if you say that we're not going to allow, we don't want people to develop secure communications, then you are really committing us to a future in which the capability of anybody to do extraordinary mischief, which is what we're dealing with now, is going to continue as far as one can see.
Well, that's a solution, though, in search of a problem. I don't think there's any demonstrated problem with insecure communications right now on a broad scale that can't be fixed by very basic hygiene and other issues. And, the director of the NSA will tell you this himself, that, the spying and the snooping and the NSA control isn't even necessary. And overwhelmingly, the things that affect people's lives online, like having their bank account emptied or phishing scam emails and things like that, are really matters of hygiene. And if people are smart and they're educated and do very basic things to protect themselves, we could eradicate huge percentage of the online threats.
It's important not to confuse the sense in which what you're saying is true and the sense in which it isn't. It's entirely right, and I say so often, that terrible practices make a lot of the problems as bad as they are. But I have clients who, in major, defense, aerospace kinds of industries, who are dealing with nation-state attacks.
Oh, yeah. Advanced persistent threats, that's different. And those will not be combated by having everyday internet users, have some sort of verification or credentialing. The Boeings, these companies that are working at a high level and are probably the top targets for corporate espionage and infiltration and things like that, they're operating at a completely different level and need to do other things for their systems than the everyday internet user, though, right?
Not exactly, because they're dealing with everyday internet users and people in there. And the whole phishing thing, for example, is enabled because one doesn't know who one's dealing with. So again, the boundary between the problem set that you and I would agree can be handled easily and the problem set that we can't is very hard to draw. Very hard to draw.
Again, getting back to that whole debate over what is the spectrum of responsibility for cybersecurity.
And also, you know, when it's really true that if people engaged in better hygiene, this problem set would go away. Companies that don't bother to patch their systems, that kind of thing, it's quite inexcusable. But the truth is that when you leave security in the hands of the users, you don't get very much security. And we know that's not likely to change because we're dealing with human behavior.
Well, then they passed the seatbelt law and people started to wear seatbelts, right? And
mm-hmm.
we started to have fewer highway fatalities. Are there any final remarks before I think we're going to have to wrap this up? It's been a great
discussion.
Well,
I just want to thank you, Ellen, and everybody who's participated. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, thanks to all. Ellen, you did great.
Thank you to everyone. Really a great conversation and look forward to more. Thanks again.
Well, this is Dean Reuter with the Federalist Society. I'm breaking in again and thanking Ellen Nakashima and our other panelists for joining us today. This has certainly been an interesting conversation, and we will probably have occasion to revisit these issues in the not-too-distant future. For the audience, I invite you to join us for our upcoming Teleform conference call on Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time when we'll be launching our Executive Branch Review Project. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.